In Foreign Policy Magazine, our current guest writes, "Welcome to the new food economics of 2011. Prices are climbing, but the impact is not at all being felt equally. For Americans who spend less than one-tenth of their income in the supermarket, the soaring food prices we've seen so far this year are an annoyance, not a calamity. But for the planet's poorest 2 billion people who spend 50 to 70% of their income on food, these soaring prices may mean going from two meals a day to one. Those who are barely hanging on to the lower rungs of the global economic ladder risk losing their grip entirely. This can contribute, and it has, to revolutions and upheaval." Lester Brown is our guest this hour, founder and president of Earth Policy Institute, author of World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. He has been called by the Washington Post one of the world's most influential thinkers. He started his career as a farmer growing tomatoes in southern New Jersey with his younger brother during high school and college. He got a degree in agricultural science from Rutgers University, spent 6 months living in rural India, where he became familiar with the Food Population Institute. In 1959, he joined the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Foreign Agricultural Service as an international agricultural agent. He became an advisor in 1964 to Secretary of Agriculture Orville Freeman on foreign agricultural policy. And in 1974, he founded the World Watch Institute, the first research institute devoted to the analysis of global environmental issues. He has authored or co-authored 50 books, and he founded the Earth Policy Institute in 2001 to provide a vision and a roadmap for achieving an environmentally sustainable economy. He has won many awards for his work, and what we have to talk about today is vitally important. Lester Brown, thank you very much for being with us.
Kathleen, my pleasure.
This book, this article that you wrote is really disturbing because it is so important and it's something we just don't think about very much.
Well, as one who's been involved in agriculture one way or another for well over half a century now, I have the opportunity of seeing things in a historical perspective that not everyone does. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is quite clear is that during the last half of the last century, the big issue in international trade was always access to markets. It was the United States, Canada, Australia, and Argentina getting together and hammering the Europeans and the Japanese to open their markets to fair competition. Well, they never did open their markets very much. But what has happened in recent years, as we've turned the century and come into this new decade, is that the issue has shifted from access to markets to access to supplies. It's importing countries now who want assurances that they'll have access to exportable supplies when they need them, and that's the big change. And what we saw in early 2007, late 2007 and early 2008, when grain prices and soybean prices more than doubled, was that there was sort of a panic developing in the importing countries because exporting countries were beginning to restrict exports. Russia and Argentina both severely restricted their wheat exports. Vietnam, number two rice exporter in the world, banned rice exports for several months. So suddenly, importing countries panicked. And what that has led to is these the more affluent importing countries like Saudi Arabia, South Korea, China, are acquiring land in other countries, either buying it or leasing it long term.
I had no idea that was going on.
On which to feed themselves. And the scale of this is actually huge. Most of the land acquisitions, that's the diplomatic term, land acquisitions, for the NGOs working on this, they're land grabs. But the total of these agreements, which are now several hundred, mostly in Africa, but some in Southeast Asia and quite a few in Latin America, totals about 125 million acres, according to the World Bank. 125 million acres is equal to the area in wheat and corn combined in the United States.
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that something?
It's not a trivial thing that's going on here, and exactly where it's going to take us is not clear at this point.
And then they take all of that food and just ship it right out of the country?
Yes.
Ship it home.
Ship it home. And that raises a potentially sensitive political issue, which is if there are a lot of hungry people in the country, and two of the principal targets, by the way, of these land acquisitions are Ethiopia and the Sudan, both of which have millions of hungry people, many of them on the UN's World Food Program sort of food lifeline. But what happens when the trucks start to haul the grain produced by investors from abroad to the nearest port to ship it back home? I can't imagine the hungry people are just going to stand by and watch that grain leave their country. So this is a situation that's fraught with political risk.
And go back for a moment to the restriction of exports on the part of countries like the Soviet Union. Why are they restricting exports?
Well, we saw this most recently last summer when there was an extreme heat wave in Western Russia and a severe drought along with it. And they saw their grain harvest dropped from what they hoped would be about 100 million tons down to 60 million tons. And then they panicked because their food prices were rising very fast, and they were afraid of the political consequences, so they banned exports of grain totally. And that had obvious effects on many countries. For example, not too long before that heat wave, Egypt had negotiated a multi-year agreement whereby the Russians would supply Egypt with 3 million tons of wheat per year. Egypt imports about 10 million tons. It is the world's leading wheat importer now, having some time back eclipsed Japan. But then suddenly, Egypt, which was thought it could count on Russia for at least 3 million tons of wheat a year because they had an agreement, discovered that that agreement really didn't hold. And then they had to scramble, you know, at the last minute, sort of, to see where they could find enough wheat. And they, you know, through a number of small purchases in France and the U.S. and Canada, they finally got that 3 million tons together. But it was not easy, and for them it was a bit scary.
Mm-hmm. And what about the U.S.? Have countries brokered deals for lease or sale, a purchase of land in this country?
You know, this is a country where it would be difficult to acquire large blocks of land because a lot of, you know, families have been on the land for generations and they wouldn't just walk away. The reason it's much easier to acquire large blocks of land in developing countries is because there often are no land titles.
I see.
You know, people in villages have been living there and cultivating, you know, certain plots of land for a long, long time, but there is no deed on file anyplace that says, you know, our family owns this piece of land. And so when someone comes in and buys the land, with the local government's consent, then these people just lose their land and they're displaced. And that's another source of stress.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of political unrest that's been generated by these land grabs. Now, what's happening in the United States represents the next stage in this evolution of the geopolitics of food. Because the U.S. is such a major producer and exporter, the world's largest grain exporter by far, it would be good to be able to buy some land here, big chunks of land, particularly in the Midwest, and produce grain to ship back home. But that land is not for sale. So what's happening is that, and this is what South Korea is doing, and it's the first in this new genre of efforts to tie down exportable supplies of grain. South Korea has created a new sort of public-private entity, and its purpose is to acquire at least part of the grain that South Korea imports. South Korea is self-sufficient in rice, but imports almost all its wheat and feed grains, which is about 70% of its total grain consumption. So they're opening an office in Chicago, and the purpose of that office will be to either lease or buy some grain elevators in the rural areas of the probably in the Midwest, and then buy grain directly from farmers and put it in those grain elevators.
Oh my.
And what that will enable them to do is to control the grain from the time it leaves the farm in the U.S. until it reaches consumers in South Korea. It's interesting because it bypasses the international grain trading companies and it ties up the grain before it gets into the market. So what this is almost certainly going to lead to is other countries doing the same thing, like China or Saudi Arabia or Japan.
Right.
And then the issue, now it gets really interesting politically, because at what point will the purchases of grain by these importing countries directly from U.S. farmers put us in a situation where suddenly we realize there's not enough left for us anymore?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's so shocking here, because this is really a worldwide, part of a worldwide struggle for food security. And as I think I mentioned in the article, food is sort of becoming the new oil. Whoever controls the food really has a lot of leverage on the world economy and the world political situation.
And when you look at the future, Lester, which you do, at what point do you think there won't be enough for us?
It's a little hard to say, and part of it will be determined by how quickly China comes into the world market for massive quantities of grain. They have been, for the last 15 years, essentially self-sufficient in grain, and they've been able to do that by overpumping their aquifers, overplowing their land, creating a huge dust bowl now in northern China and western Mongolia, and importing most of their soybeans. I mean, China is the world, is the country that gave the world the soybean, but it is now heavily dependent on soybean imports. I mean, you can tell the story with four numbers. In 1995, China produced 14 million tons of soybeans. It consumed 14 million tons of soybeans. In 2010, it again produced 14 million tons of soybeans, but it consumed 70 million tons
Whoa.
Of soybeans, which means that 56 million tons are being imported. The big growth in soybean production in response to particularly the soaring demand in China, but also in other parts of the world, including in the United States, has been an enormous growth in the land in soybeans. And that growth has been concentrated in three countries, the United States, Brazil, and Argentina. As a result of this enormous growth in the demand for soybeans, which is associated with moving up the food chain. These are not soybeans for direct consumption in the form of tofu or meat substitutes or whatever. It's soybean meal mixed with grain to feed to cattle and pigs and chickens and so forth. But what it has translated into is a situation where in the United States there's now more land in soybeans than in wheat. In Brazil, there's twice as much land in soybeans as in all grains combined. And in in Brazil, there's more land in soybeans than all grains combined. And in Argentina, there's twice as much land in soybeans as all grains combined. Argentina is becoming a soybean monoculture, with most of the exports going to China. In fact, 60% of all the soybeans that go into world trade now, and almost all that comes from these three countries, goes to China. And if you look at the Western Hemisphere, the entire Western Hemisphere from Canada south through Argentina, there is now more land in soybeans than either wheat or corn.
My goodness.
That's how much the world farm economy, at least in the Western Hemisphere, has been restructured in response to this massive growth in the demand for soybeans.
We need to pause for just a moment and we'll return. Lester Brown is our guest this hour, founder and president of Earth Policy Institute, author of World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. And for those of you who know him, you know he's been in this work in a very profound way and groundbreaking way for a number of years. He's written a piece that caught our attention in Foreign Policy Magazine, The New Geopolitics of Food, from the Middle East to Madagascar. High prices are spawning land grabs and ousting dictators. Welcome to the 21st century food wars. Here's our phone number. Get a line while you can, because there's only one. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, Dick Van Dyke will be with us. He has a memoir, My Lucky Life, In and Out of Show Business. It's tomorrow during this time period. We go to phone calls now for Lester Brown, and let's start with Ned in Wausau. Hi, Ned.
Hi. One of the things that's important to grain production is water availability, and both the droughts and the floods worldwide that are partially due to the increased rate of them, partially due to climate change and global warming, has made a major impact on grain production. And so what happens is, it's, from my knowledge anyway, is that the countries that might have a little grain to spare are shipping grain because it's much easier to ship grain than ship water to areas with droughts, for example. And so it's not just water. I realize it's nutrients and fertilizer of various types and other things, but one of the key players in grain production is the availability of water. So it's just a new way of looking at things. The way we seem to have to deal with droughts, especially droughts, and to some extent flooding, is to deal with it by shipping grain to those countries with the drought.
That's a good point, Ned. The water issue is really, in many ways, at the heart of the food issue today, because it is the lack of water more than the lack of land that's restricting production. You mentioned the amount of water that it takes to produce food, and I don't think most of us are fully aware of this. We drink, as typical adults, close to 4 quarts of water a day, as water, coffee, juice, wine, whatever. But the water required to produce the food we eat each day is roughly 2,000 quarts of water a day, or 500 times as much. And that's why water is so important, as you indicate. One of the most interesting water developments underway right now is in the Upper Nile River Basin. Egypt, which is just in the throes of creating a young new democracy, a real democracy, is unique in that it either imports its grain or imports the water to produce grain via the Nile River. Now, it consumes maybe 18 million tons of wheat a year, 10 million tons of that is imported, 8 million tons produced domestically. But the problem is that the two principal countries in the upper Nile River Basin, the Sudan and Ethiopia, are two of the countries where many of the land grabs are occurring. And these land acquisitions are also water acquisitions, because the land without water in much of this area is not worth very much. And so since all the water in the Nile is currently being used, that is, when the Nile reaches the Mediterranean, there is very little water left in it. It's sort of like the Colorado in the U.S. reaching the Gulf of California. There's not much water left when it gets there, if any at all. And so these land grabs, some of which involve hundreds of thousands of acres, will be taking, many of them, water from the upper Nile tributaries, thus reducing the amount of water reaching Egypt and making Egypt and even more Egypt's food situation even more precarious than it already is. So that's one of the examples of how the changing geopolitics of food are affecting the distribution of water. And you also mentioned climate change, Ned. I think you mentioned the two important sort of new negative influences on world the world food prospect. One is spreading water shortages as a result of aquifer depletion, and the second is climate change. The rule of thumb that crop ecologists use in assessing the effect of rising temperature is that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature above the norm during the growing season, we can expect a 10% decline in grain yields. Beyond that, when we look at agriculture as it exists today, it's clear that it evolved over an 11,000-year period of rather remarkable climate stability. I mean, there were a few blips here and there, but basically it's been a pretty stable climate. So agriculture is designed to maximize production with that climate system. But that climate system is now changing very fast. And, in fact, it is no longer the same system. And each year, as the climate system keeps changing, agriculture will be more and more out of sync with it. And it's that broader effect of how a changing climate system means there's a growing disconnect between agriculture as it evolved with the old climate system and this new climate system, which is changing fast. Among other things, there's no norm to go back to. It used to be if there was a weather event someplace in the world that tightened food supplies, like a monsoon failure in India or drought in the former Soviet Union or what have you, that we would just bring some idle cropland back into production in the U.S., and within a year, things would go back to normal. But one, we don't have the idle cropland in the U.S. anymore, so we've lost that cushion. And two, there's no normal to go back to because the system is changing all the time. And I don't think we've yet quite realized how difficult it's going to become for the world's farmers to try to maintain production and even growth in production, which is what's needed, when the climate system is changing in ways that we don't very well understand.
Thank you, Ned, very much for the call. Let's go to Maura from New Berlin. Hi, Maura.
Hi, Kathleen and Lester Brown. Thank you for this critical discussion. I was just wondering, when Lester mentioned early on about these practices whereby citizens are virtually ejected because there's no title to the land, under what authority do these countries have to do this, and isn't this a matter that should be condemned by the world community?
It is being condemned by a group of more than 100 NGOs working on this. But one of the things you have to keep in mind is that there's probably quite a bit of money passing under the table. So the political leaders in these states or in the local provinces are quite prepared to sell off chunks of land because they're going to benefit from it one way or another in a personal sense. And they're not really too concerned about the local people. They say, oh, well, you know, they'll be able to get jobs on these farms. But the reality is that the agriculture being brought in is very modern, high-tech, capital-intensive, highly mechanized agriculture. It doesn't create many jobs at all. And so it's a very painful thing to see what's happening with people. Just wake up as one young Ethiopian who was in London was describing his village back in Ethiopia. He said one day people just showed up with big tractors and bulldozers and things and started preparing the land for a crop, you know, on a huge scale. And they didn't really, just sort of ignored the local people. And that's what's happening in many, many places. The other thing that's happening is a lot of these land acquisitions, these land grabs, if you will, are not really being, this land is not being acquired to produce. It is being acquired by speculators.
Oh, dear.
As someone said, land is the new gold. We know its value is going to be going up in the future. And so why not buy as much of it as you can today? So even investment banks are buying large tracts of land, and they have no capacity to farm and don't plan to farm the land. They're just buying it and speculating with it.
You, at the end of the article, talk about the upheavals that greeted dictators in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya, a country that imports 90% of its grain, which is information to me, new. Get ready, farmers and foreign ministers alike, for a new era in which world food scarcity increasingly shapes global politics. Did food have anything to do with the upheavals in the aforementioned country? And what do you anticipate could happen in terms of food scarcity shaping in what way global politics?
Right. There have been a few cases where, in the last few years, governments have been overthrown or voted out of office. In Haiti, for example, when the government was not able to respond to the surge in food prices back in 2008, the president was forced to resign. I think it was in Madagascar where the head of state arranged for a huge sale of grain to Dawu, D-A-E-W-O-O-O, a large Korean conglomerate, which had bought, I don't know, like 2 million acres of land or something. And this so upset people that they actually overthrew, I think in the next election, throughout the existing government and brought in a new government that was running on the platform that they would cancel that agreement. And that's exactly what happened. Now, beyond that, rising food prices are very sensitive in developing countries, much more so than here, because we're so isolated by processing and marketing and all the things in between. But in many countries, I mean, in Egypt, for example, which is far and away the largest country in the Arab world, in Egypt, the government heavily subsidizes bread. So probably 60% or more of the Egyptian people get in bread lines. There are thousands of these huge bakeries around the country to get this subsidized bread. I mean, Egypt is a country of bread eaters, and if the government's not able to maintain that subsidy as prices rise, then this will become a very politically sensitive point. But there is general agreement that rising food prices and growing food insecurity on the part of people in importing countries, and virtually all of the Arab countries import part of their grain, in some cases most of their grain. And so that becomes a sensitive issue, and it's generally recognized to be one of the issues underlying the so-called Arab Spring, end quote.
We go to Habu from Madison next. Hi, Habu.
Yes, good morning, and thank you. Just a couple of very quick points. One, I haven't heard your esteemed guest talk about the manipulation of the grain markets that's occurring on Wall Street. And this is being done by pension funds, mutual funds, and speculators. Vandana Shiva, an esteemed Indian physicist who has an NGO, has talked about this. And the second thing is, while I'm somewhat averse to what is going on about this land grab, I think it's not a bad thing after all, because right now, as the situation is, everything is grain prices are decided in Chicago, and having a central area kind of decide the prices, I think, is wrong, and it creates structural problems. So I'd like your guest to address these two issues. Thank you.
There's no question but that once grain markets become unstable and begin to fluctuate a lot, and particularly to fluctuate around a rising trend, that you get a lot of speculation, some of it just by people who live by speculating, and others, in other cases, it is. It's, you know, our pension funds and what have you, who see an opportunity, so they'll put some of their investments into you know, wheat futures or soybean futures or whatever. And the net effect of that is to escalate the rise in prices. When speculators get into the market, they both amplify the upswings and the downswings, and that creates more instability. So it is definitely a problem. As to the whether or not the land grabs are a good idea, it seems to me that one of the most important things we need to think about in developing agriculture in developing countries, in Africa, for example, is the creation of jobs, because it is one of the other trends in the Arab countries, other than rising food prices, that has contributed to the unrest, is the growing number of young people who cannot find jobs, including some of her college graduates, but including particularly a lot of young men. And when they can't find jobs, they use their energy in some other way. And these revolutions have been the principal manifestation of that. So that would be my I'm concerned about the lack of creating jobs when we desperately need jobs in the developing countries, and the fact that almost all the inputs, whether it's the farm equipment or the fertilizer or the pesticides or whatever, used in these large commercial operations are brought into the country. Almost everything that's produced goes out of the country, so there's very little involvement of the local economy in this process, and that, I think, is not the the sort of development model that we want to encourage.
Let's talk about eating up for a moment. And I know that you write about this in the article as well, that it used to be, if you were in a developing country, you didn't eat a whole lot of meat. You didn't eat rich kinds of things as we have in the United States for years and years now. Is that still the way, as countries become wealthier, that they eat better, they eat more meat, they eat more food that takes a lot more to produce in terms of what you have to feed the animals, et cetera? Is that part of a problem here, or is it not significant?
There are three sources of growing demand for grain in the world today. One is population growth, 80 million people a year, and that means there'll be 219,000 people at the dinner table tonight who were not there last night.
Goodness.
And tomorrow night, another 219,000. Some of them, incidentally, with empty plates. But this incessant growth of population is beginning to stress the Earth's land and water resources and the skills of farmers. The second source of growing demand is rising affluence. And we estimate there are probably close to 3 billion people in the world today who are trying to move up the what I call the food chain or the grain requirements ladder, consuming more grain-intensive livestock products. That may be beef or pork or poultry, milk, eggs, cheese, ice cream, yogurt, all those things that that come from the livestock sector. If you look at what this translates into, just to use some round numbers, the average person in India consumes about 400 pounds of grain per year, or roughly a pound a day. When you only have a pound of grain per day, you can't convert much of that into animal protein. You have to consume almost all of it directly just to sort of keep body and soul together. In this country, we consume about 1,600 pounds of grain per person per day, of which we consume only a small part, very small part, directly in the form of bread and pasta and breakfast cereals and so forth. Most of it we consume in the form of meat, milk, and eggs. And so that's the issue. Now, the interesting thing is that the healthiest people in the world are not those consuming 400 pounds of grain per day, as in India, or 1,600 pounds of grain per day, as in the United States, but those consuming 600 or 800 pounds a day, as in Italy, for example,
mm-hmm.
which is why we talk about the healthy benefits of the Mediterranean diet, because they have enough animal protein in the diet to satisfy nutritional needs easily, but they don't consume excessive amounts as we do, and it contributes to our obesity and health problems, just consuming too many fat-rich livestock products.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Lori from Viroqua. Hi, Lori.
Hi, good morning. I'd like Dr. Brown to comment, and the current agriculture and food system that we have is a result of, you know, decades of years of policy that has pushed us to chemical intensive, monocultural, export-based agriculture. Perhaps Dr. Brown would comment on the food sovereignty movement. Dr. Vandana Shiva is part of that, the Via Campesina, which would emphasize local production and diversity, which it seems in this era of climate change, that's what we should be looking at, is a hugely diverse food system, and it would also be more labor-intensive. It's been the goal of industrial agriculture to replace human labor with technology, and one would say,
Okay.
Thank you.
Lester?
Yeah. One of the interesting things that's happening in the world today is that as we transition from heavy dependence on fossil fuels to much greater dependence on renewables, wind and solar and geothermal and so forth, one of the consequences of the is the localization of energy production. As the energy sector becomes more and more localized, so too will the food sector, because it was the oil age that made it possible for us to ship fresh produce, you know, halfway around the world without having to worry about how much the oil costs. That's changing now. And as the price of oil goes up, as it almost certainly will in the years and decades ahead, it is going to encourage the localization of agriculture. And we're already seeing this. I mean, we see it in more than 5,000 farmers' markets in this country. We see more and more people and in more towns and communities. We have community gardens where people can get a plot of land to produce some of their food. We're seeing an increase in the number of small farms in this country, 20 to 40 acres. Many of them, incidentally, being operated by women, because they're much more a part of the local of the localization of the food economy than our men. So we're seeing some interesting shifts in this in the sort of geographic structure of agriculture. But for countries that are densely populated and thus have to import much of their grain, there's still going to be a need for even larger production for grain export in the future than there is today. I mean, you think about a country like Japan. Japan is self-sufficient in rice, but it imports almost all its wheat and feed grains, which means it's importing well over 70% of its grain. And there's no easy way to reduce that.
We're going to take more phone calls in a moment. Lester Brown is our guest in the May-June issue of Foreign Policy Magazine. His writing on the new geopolitics of food from the Middle East to Madagascar. High prices are spawning land grabs and ousting dictators. Welcome to the 21st century food wars. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We have a couple emails we'll get to in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email that's come in, Lester, from Tom. Your guest has done a great job of explaining the problems we all face in regards to both water and food supply. What does he see as possible solutions, both locally and globally?
Well, the article in Foreign Policy is about the geopolitics of food, but it's taken the material in it's taken largely from the book World on the Edge, and the last half of the book World on the Edge talks about what we need to do. And there are essentially four principles principal activities in what we call Plan B. Plan A is business as usual, which we don't think is going to be a viable concept much longer. Plan B calls for cutting carbon emissions 80% by 2020, not by 2050, which is what political leaders like to talk about. We think we've got to move much faster if, for example, we want to save the Greenland ice sheet. The second thing is we need to try to stabilize population not more than 8 billion. It's now almost 7 billion. And the way to do that is one is to eradicate poverty, which is the third activity and or principal component in Plan B. And also to fill the family planning gap. There are something like 215 million women in the world today who want to plan their families but do not know about or do not have access to reproductive health care and family planning services. So that gap needs to be filled. So it's cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050, stabilize population sooner rather than later, and eradicate poverty. The fourth component is to rebuild the natural support systems on which the economy depends. That means reforestation, grassland restoration, soil conservation, the restoration of fisheries, and so forth. No civilization has ever survived the ongoing destruction of its natural support systems, nor will ours. That's why this fourth component is so important. So we do talk about what needs to be done in World on the Edge in some detail. And the book, incidentally, is available online at earthpolicy.org.
Earthpolicy.org. And how much faith do you have that we're going to make the progress that is urgently needed on all of those goals as quickly as we need to?
Well, we've got to do a lot. We have to do it fast. And it's hard to see right now how we're going to get that rapid change. But we're probably moving toward a tipping point of some sort on these issues, and it may be driven by the emerging geopolitics of food and by rising food prices. It is rising food prices that may convince a lot of people that the rising temperatures associated with climate change are going to be very costly. So we've we've got to think about how to mobilize almost in a wartime sort of situation. And I, when I realize how much there is to do and how little time we have in which to do it, I go back and look at the economic history of World War II, and particularly of the United States in 1942. There was the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. Extraordinarily successful, sunk a large part of the U.S. Pacific Fleet that was at anchor in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. 1 month later, January 6, 1942, President Roosevelt laid out U.S. arms production goals. He said, we're going to produce 45,000 tanks, 60,000 planes, a few thousand ships. I mean, people couldn't imagine producing arms on this scale. But what he and his colleagues realized was that at that time, the largest single concentration of industrial power in the world was in the U.S. automobile industry. So after his State of the Union address, when he laid out these goals, he called in the leaders of the automobile industry and said, because you guys represent such a large share of our industrial capacity, we're going to rely heavily on you to help reach these arms production goals. And they said, well, Mr. President, we're going to do everything we can, but it's going to be a stretch to produce cars and all these arms, too. He said, you don't understand. We're going to ban the sale of cars in the United States. And that's exactly what happened from early 1942 until the end of 1944, roughly 3 years. There were essentially no cars produced in the United States, and we exceeded every one of those arms production goals.
Fascinating. Joe in Harper's Ferry. Hi.
Hi. I'd like you to comment on the balance between capitalism and government in solving these problems. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
There are some things that we're very good at, that the market is very good at. For example, when you have a huge market for corn, as we do in the United States, you can get the seed companies to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in research in developing better, higher-yielding varieties. But in local places in Africa, the seed companies aren't interested because the potential sales are so low and the people don't have the money to buy seed anyhow. They just save seed from their existing crops with traditional varieties, not high-yielding hybrids. So the market does some things very well. And my sort of personal take on this is the things that the market does well, we should let it do. And the role of government is to fill the gaps where the market doesn't satisfy our needs, doesn't respond to our problems as a society.
And thank you very much for the call. Well, there's a lot to be done, Lester, isn't there?
Yeah, we could go for a few more days, probably.
I know. And I guess the thing that I come away with is realizing the extent of this, and I'm a little worried about how ready we are to enact the kinds of changes that we need to enact.
Well, it's having discussions like the one we're just having now for the past hour to help people think about and help ourselves think about these issues. It's partly an educational process, and
yes,
and that's why we do books like World on the Edge, because we have the luxury of spending all our time gathering information and analyzing it and then making it available, and we typically do that in book form.
Yeah, and tell us again how people can get that.
Our website is earthpolicy.org.
Earthpolicy.org, okay.
The book can be downloaded free of charge, or if you want something to put on a shelf, you can buy a hard copy. I think it's $15 or something like that.
All right. Thank you, Lester, so much for being with us and for all your work.
Kathleen, thank you for having me as your guest today.
Yes, our great pleasure. Lester Brown, founder and president of Earth Policy Institute, author of World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. He has been, and you can see why, rightfully so, considered one of the world's most influential thinkers, The Telegraph of Calcutta refers to him as the guru of the environmental movement. He started many years ago growing tomatoes in southern New Jersey with his brother and earned a degree in agricultural science from Rutgers University in 1955 and has done work all over the world. He founded the Institute to provide a vision and a roadmap for achieving an environmentally sustainable economy. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Tomorrow during this time period, Dick Van Dyke will be joining us. He has a book with a wonderful cover. It just epitomizes who he is. He's kicking his leg high and dancing. My Lucky Life in and Out of Show Business. Dick Van Dyke will be joining us, and we'll have a little bit of comedy tomorrow as well. On Thursday, I just want to draw your attention to another really good book, Janie Scott's book on Barack Obama's mother, A Singular Woman. That's coming up on Thursday. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your calls. Great conversations ahead.